Okay, what I was saying before we changed the tape is simply that we don't have historical empirical evidence that capitalist societies see increasing misery for their working class. Instead, we see the working class gets better off. Now, does that mean the working class is perfectly happy in a capitalist society? No, but that's a different question. Because everybody, this is just natural to follow in human nature, everybody wants to do better, and until everybody has what everybody else has, there's always going to be some people who want more. Okay, but that's not a big problem. That's just part of the nature of living in this world. But do the workers improve their lot under capitalism? The answer is yes, they do. But it was central to Marx's rational scientific analysis of history that the proletariat always increases in misery until they have to what? Through democratic or maybe violent means bring about a revolution and equalize what people enjoy. That is, the idea of a sensed alienation that increases in the proletariat, crucial to Marxist analysis, is just not found in history. Moreover, Marx was guilty of a blind faith in inevitable progress. A blind faith in inevitable progress. Marx's view of history promises, after all, things are going to get better. There's going to be progress. It is necessary that history do that. Well, the difficulty is that this progress that we're supposed to see has only prevailed by internal repression in every communist country of the world. We're not talking about a tendency here. We're not talking about the majority. We're talking about every single communist country in the world has maintained communism, not by inevitable progress, things getting better and better, but by internal repression. When people think things are going to get better and it's inevitable, that leads them to politically and socially disastrous decisions to throw off their present governments, like the Russian Tsar, as though nothing could be worse. Progress is inevitable, so obviously the revolution is better than what we have. Well, so how's it going? Let's do a little reality check here. What did the revolution bring to Russia? Did things get better and better than they had under the Tsar? No, they didn't. But Marx's idealistic, utopian notion that progress is inevitable leads people to precipitously throw off government because they think it's got to be better than this, when in fact it can be worse than what they have. And that's what people in Russia have experienced. Moreover, Marxist economic experiments have not led to free and prosperous societies. Marxism has led to starvation. Moreover, far from moving toward a stateless society where human nature is going to naturally improve and become more dignified, Marxism in actual history has everywhere, emphasize everywhere, led to the trampling on human dignity, violations of moral decency, and sweeping violence. That was true of the gulags of Russia. It was true under Lenin, true under Stalin, true under Pol Pot, true under Mao, true under Castro. How much empirical historical evidence do we need? Marxism and its alleged stateless society as a goal does not improve human nature. It leads to human rights violation on a massive scale, always, always in the name of emergency conditions. As Francis Schaeffer points out, given the humanistic basis for Marxism, its morals are always arbitrary. So Marx may have spoken in highfalutin utopian terms about how human nature is going to be improved. People are going to lose their alienation, no longer have this competition. Things are going to get better, more peaceful, more prosperous. But we have not seen more prosperity, nor have we seen an improvement in human nature under communist regimes, but the very opposite. We've seen hell on earth in the name of the workers' paradise. Now, I realize I'm preaching now, but it's life and death stuff here. Ideas have consequences. I want you to see that Marxism, for all of, you know, we can go through all these fancy ideas and even come to understand them and say, boy, doesn't that look nice, doesn't work, and in fact produces great trauma on earth for people. Marx himself said that his system should be judged by its consequences. That's what Marx said. And so I've done the favor of following him. I'm judging it by its consequences, and I find it wanting terribly. I want to read the last four pages of Thomas Sowell's assessment of Marxism. I really don't think I could do a whole lot better than the way he has put it. Marx and Engels argued that an individual or an era must be judged not by what they intend or conceive, but by what they actually accomplish. Marxism itself cannot be exempt from this standard. What Marx accomplished was to produce such a comprehensive, dramatic, and fascinating vision that it could withstand innumerable empirical contradictions, logical refutations, and moral revulsions at its effects. The Marxian vision took the overwhelming complexity of the real world and made the parts fall into place in a way that was intellectually exhilarating and conferred such sense of moral superiority that opponents could be simply labeled and dismissed as moral lepers or blind reactionaries. Marxism was and remains a mighty instrument for the acquisition and maintenance of political power. Once such an instrument has come into existence, those who wield the enormous power it makes possible have every incentive to use it and preserve it for their own purposes, regardless of what purposes may have motivated Marx or Engels. But however instrumental Marxism becomes in the hands of latter-day power wielders, its intellectual structure and foundation do not become irrelevant. On the contrary, precisely as it is applied in the real world, intellectual flaws and blemishes, too slight to be noticed amid the heavy rhetoric, become manifest in terms as concrete as hunger, terror, and death. Lenin was unique in having to confront the failure of his assumptions and having to improvise an alternative while literally millions died around him, some from starvation and others slaughtered by his secret police in the Red Army, both of whom drowned in blood the revolt of the very masses in whose name they ruled. While in one sense this represented the unfolding of erroneous assumptions implicit in Marxism, in a larger sense it represented the hubris of imagining that a whole society could be constructed from the ground up on the vision of one man rather than evolving from the experiences of millions spread over the generations for the centuries. It was not simply that Marx happened to be unequal to the task, but that anyone was foredoomed to be unequal to such a task. And now I might add by analysis, I certainly agree, only God is equal to the task of what Marx was trying to do. Despite choosing a world stage in which to operate, Marx's vision was a very insular one. Much of Marx's conception of the capitalist and of the capitalist economy reflected the insularity of the urban intellectual. Marx repeatedly depicted and disdained the capitalist entrepreneur as an uncultured parvenu, someone lacking in bookish accomplishments, as if these were the universal litmus test of contributions to society. Marx's own life was the most overwhelming evidence that bookish accomplishments and economic effectiveness had no necessary correlation. Similar narrowness and snobbery were evident toward what the Communist Manifesto called, quote, the idiocy of rural life, a foretaste of Marxist inability to take farmers seriously or to manage agriculture effectively. The Marxist constituency has remained as narrow as the conception behind it. The Communist Manifesto, written by two bright and articulate young men without responsibility, even for their own livelihoods, much less for the social consequences of their vision, has had a special appeal for successive generations of the same kinds of people. The offspring of privilege have dominated the leadership of Marxist movements from the days of Marx and Engels through Lenin, Mao, Castro, Ho Chi Minh, and their lesser counterparts around the world and down through history. The sheer reiteration of the, quote, working class theme in Marxism has drowned out this plain fact. Do you hear what he's saying? He's saying Marxism has been advanced by privileged children from wealthy families to get an education, not from the working class. But the crucial point is not privilege as such, but the insulation from responsibility that that provides, particularly during youth. Intellectuals enjoy a similar insulation from the consequences of being wrong in a way that no businessman, military leader, engineer, or even athletic coach can. Intellectuals and the young have remained historically the groups most susceptible to Marxism, even though the young have often abandoned it as they grew older and more experienced, being replaced by ever-renewed sources of more youths following in their wake. The disjuncture between vision and experience was nowhere better illustrated than in the traumatic post-revolutionary experience of Lenin, as he applied the Marxist vision and watched a whole nation sink into economic chaos and starvation by the millions. The Leninist, Stalinist modifications, that is, betrayals of Marxism, have mitigated the severity of the Soviet Union's economic problems, but at the cost of turning a humanitarian creed into a ruthless mode of power consolidation. Both denunciations and apologetics for this often miss the point that a vision that departs from reality must either be abandoned or changed. Despite the massive intellectual feat that Marx's Kapital represents, the Marxian contribution to economics can be readily summarized as virtually zero. Professional economics as it exists today reflects no indication that Karl Marx ever existed. This neither denies nor denigrates Kapital as an intellectual achievement, and perhaps in its way, the culmination of classical economics. But the development of modern economics has simply ignored Marx. Even economists who are Marxists typically utilize a set of analytical tools to which Marx contributed nothing, and they have recourse to Marx only for ideological, political, or historical purposes. In professional economics, Kapital was a detour into a blind alley, however historic it may be, as the centerpiece of a worldwide political movement. What is said and done in its name is said and done largely by people who have never read through it, much less followed its labyrinth reasoning, from its arbitrary postulates to its empirically false conclusions. Instead, the massive volumes of Kapital have become a quasi-magic touchstone, a source of assurance that somewhere and somehow a genius proved capitalism to be wrong and doomed, even if the specifics of this proof are unknown to those who take their certitude from it. In agriculture especially, Marxist grand dismissals of what they did not understand had far-reaching practical consequences, including desperate food shortages in modern communist nations, dependence on grain imports from the West, Stalin's wholesale slaughter of the kulaks, and innumerable agricultural reforms, the most effective of which proved to be allowing some portion of agriculture to operate on a market system. In the Soviet Union, the market sector occupies only 3% of the farm land, but produces about 30% of the Soviet agricultural output. The supreme irony of Marxism was that a fundamentally humane and egalitarian creed was so dominated by a bookish perspective that it became blind to facts and deaf to humanity and freedom. Yet the moral vision and the intellectual aura of Marxism continued to disarm critics, quiet doubters, and put opponents on the moral defensive. It has provided both intellectual and moral insulation for those who wield power in its name. Some of the most distinguished names in Western civilization, George Bernard Shaw, Jean-Paul Sartre, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, among others, have become apologists for brutal dictatorships ruling in the name of Marx and committing atrocities that they would never countenance under any other label. People who could never be corrupted by money or power may nevertheless be blinded by a vision. In this context, there are grim implications to Engels' claim that Marx's name and work, quote, will endure through the ages. As we begin this morning, let's again come to the Lord in prayer. Father, we come before your throne of grace, grateful that it is indeed a throne of grace. Because if you were not indulgent toward us, if you were not patient with us, if you were not so ready to forgive, we know that we would not be able to come before you. Lord, if you were to mark iniquities, none of us could stand. We do come to you through the intercession of our great high priest, Jesus Christ, and do ask that for his sake you would hear us and that you would love us and continue your love, not only through this day, but through all eternity. We do pray that you would give us a sense of acceptance with you, that you would take away our fear of judgment, that we might know that you are truly a heavenly Father, and that you care for us, that you are compassionate to us. And it's only for that reason that you are gracious and compassionate that we enjoy the benefits of this life that are ours. We thank you for the benefit of this class. We do pray that it would be a blessing to us, that it might truly sanctify us, that it might make us more faithful to you, that it would enable us to live in this world in a way which shows forth your glory and the truth of your word. For we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. At the end of yesterday's class, we were finishing our criticism of Marxism, which is the last major school of 19th century thought that I'm going to present to you. We have something of an artificial situation here, though. How do you distinguish between 19th century thought and 20th century thought? I mean, philosophy doesn't develop, you know, according to time periods. So that's always retrospective. When we look back, you look for joints, you know, what's a good dividing point? And in reality, there is no distinction between the thought of 1899 and the thought of 1901. They all merge into each other. But for purposes of teaching, giving a rational reconstruction of history to make it intelligible and to help make application of its themes, everyone has got to divide 19th and 20th century thought in some way. And the way I'm doing it differs from the book that I'm most fond of and dependent on in my presentation, W.T. Jones. He puts certain people in the 19th century volume that I'm treating in the 20th and vice versa. So I realize it's all somewhat fluid, but we are coming in my presentation to the end of the era, the end of the 19th century. And I'd like to give you, as your outline, your lecture outline indicates, a retrospect and prospect at the 19th century's end. In terms of retrospect, looking back at the 19th century, let me remind you, first of all, of Francis Schaeffer's summary of man's difficulty as we enter into our own century. In chapter 6 and 8 of Schaeffer, which are not assigned, they were done in our last course on Renaissance and Enlightenment thought, in those two chapters, I want to remind you that Schaefer sees a breakdown, if you look at our culture and the way of thinking that is manifest in the Western world. He sees a breakdown in philosophy, in science, and in politics. First of all, the breakdown in philosophy is that, to use my own words, summarizing Schaefer, the humanist world has worked its way into such a corner that rational values don't seem possible. There are no rational values. Now, that is not to say that there's not rationality or some appearance of it, nor is it to say that there's no affirmation of values. It's to say that modern man can't bring the two together, can't bring rationality together with a value orientation in life. In fact, Schaefer says the mark of modern man is the dichotomy between value and reason. You can use your reason, but it's going to lead to despair. There are no human values, no moral values made possible. Or you can make the leap of faith and affirm individual value, but it won't have anything to do with science and reasoning. And I think that's a very helpful insight. Granted, people could say it's oversimple. Other people say it's very deep and profound. I'm closer to the deep and profound assessment of that, the problem with modern man is he cannot bring reason and his understanding of nature together with value and his understanding of how we should live as human beings. So in philosophy, the breakdown is that there are no rational values. Schaefer says Rousseau distinguished between a realm of nature and a realm of freedom. In the natural realm, we don't have freedom. We're just, you know, subject to our environment. We're just biological, you know, mechanisms, if you will. Nature doesn't show any creativity and freedom. Yet man has freedom. And so he's part of nature, and yet he's not part of nature. And Rousseau can't reconcile this. What this leads to is the notion of the noble savage. The noble savage. If you're going to have nobility, that is to show man's freedom, quality or value, nobility, it's going to be without science and civilization. It's going to have to be the savage, the undeveloped human nature. So the noble savage. No rational values. You may have value, you may have nobility, but it's not going to be rational. It's not going to be scientific, civilized. Schaefer says Kant distinguished between the phenomena and the noumena. We've talked about this so many times that you don't need a review. We have things as they appear, and then there's an ultimate reality behind that or above that or beyond it, distinguished from it, the noumena. So when Kant gets around to talking about values, he says that our duties are always categorical. He sees a formal character to man's duty, but it's an empty form because the categorical imperative can't really tell you, when all is said and done, what the substance of your duties is, but just what the form of the duties will be. Always that they have to be categorical, without exception. Treat others as you'd have them treat you, as it were. But how should you treat others? Well, it doesn't tell you. Hegel distinguishes what's distinguishing about Hegel, pardon me, is that truth is the whole. Well, if truth is the whole, if it must encompass everything, then we don't have absolute truth now. We only have conditioned truths, approximations. Moreover, on Hegel's approach, what is right, given his view of the dialectic of history. And so we don't have absolute truth available to us, but absolutes have to be imposed by the state, and whatever the state does is right because of his view of history. Again, no rational values. In the case of Goethe, we have a romantic pantheism, which Schaefer points out, and this is a real tour de force in terms of a refutation. Goethe's pantheism
would lead to the Marquis de Sade. What is right. We can do what comes natural to us. And so if men naturally dominate women, then it's all right for men to dominate women. In the case of Kierkegaard, as you remember my lecture, we have a leap of faith. We have to abandon reason and affirm what is absurd in order to find meaning in our life. Commitment comes from a leap of faith. Obviously, whatever is valuable then is separated from what is reasonable. Schaefer doesn't talk about Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, but let me add from our lectures them to the list. For Schopenhauer, there is a mystical basis for his ascetic lifestyle. The values of sympathy and self-sacrifice and asceticism are based on a mystical intuition. In the case of Nietzsche, all values are chosen. They are not pre-established. There are no universal objective values. All values are chosen by the overman, the superman. And so, as Schaefer points out, we come to the end of the 19th century, or what I'm calling the end of the 19th century, and we have a real breakdown in philosophy. There are no rational values. Value and reason have been separated from each other. Secondly, there's a breakdown in science. The naturalistic worldview has led to an evolutionary view not only of the world and animals, but of man. And given the evolutionary worldview, that can develop into racism, can justify euthanasia, can justify abortion. To put it very simply, naturalism cannot provide a moral standard, nor can it provide meaning for the world in which we live, or for mankind's life, or the life of any individual. Naturalism, then evolution, and then you have a wide open, plane for what your moral application would be, or what the meaning of life would be. The scientific view that man is a machine leads to behaviorism. And if behaviorism is true, there is no responsibility for our conduct, and there are no pre-established ethical guidelines for our conduct. Man is simply a machine. And that leaves it an open question as to how the machine should be constructed to operate, or what it should do, what it should accomplish. If naturalism cannot provide absolute values, then what happens is people choose pseudo-values, or artificial appearances of value, as in the biological sphere, the notion of survival of the race becomes something of a value. So what do we live for? The survival of the race. And then it's a short step. Again, this is not what the authors of these notions intended, but it's a short step to the Nazi regime. For the sake of the survival of the human race, we need to practice, for instance, eugenics or genocide, whatever it may be. Now what happens is natural science, according to Schaefer, tells man that he's nothing but a machine, he's nothing but a product of nature, but men cannot live like machines, and so they end up making a non-rational leap for meaning in life. That is, the scientific worldview weighs them down and so takes away their subjectivity, their freedom, their human dignity, any meaning in life, and moral absolutes. The men rebel by saying, okay, you can have the scientific way of looking at things, but then there's also a non-rational leap, if you will, into the area of meaning and morality. And then finally, Schaefer sees humanism breaking down in the political sphere as well. The example that he takes is the French Revolution. Because the French Revolution exalted the goddess of reason. And here's humanism in explicit form. We follow the goddess of reason if we're going to get our social problems and our political order worked out. And those who followed the goddess of reason were committed to the perfectibility of man. and had a utopian outlook, a utopian goal. They thought they could perfect man, that man could be perfected by reason, and that men working reasonably together could create a utopia, a blessed social and political order. What was the outcome of the French Revolution, however? For all those high hopes and that heady optimism and self-centered autonomy, the outcome of the French Revolution destroyed any optimism, because the French Revolution brought first anarchy, the reign of terror, and then repression in the form of Napoleon. So here's what man's proud reason has created, you know? Anarchy on the one hand, everybody doing his own thing, and then repression on the other, the state imposing a universal or order, a unity on things. Schaefer says this is parallel to the Russian Revolution. Now, that, of course, is a 20th century phenomenon, but in Schaefer's way of discussing this, he looks at the Russian Revolution as not so much exalting the goddess of reason in the way that France did in 1789, but in 1917 it was going to be scientific socialism. Remember, Marx wanted to be scientific, not utopian. Well, where did scientific socialism take the Russians? Well, right into repression again. Okay? You have the anarchy of the revolution, and then you have repression coming in the form of Lenin. Schaefer points out that communism has proven to be a failure. First, an economic disaster. Second, it denies freedom to people. And third, communism has no basis for ethical concern and reform. Though communists talk about human concern and wanting to get rid of alienation, they want to harmonize people and develop human potential, Schaefer says, on a humanist basis, there's no foundation there. There's no rationale for ethical concern and reform. So what I've done in the last few minutes is tried to summarize for you chapter 6 and 8 in Schaefer as a reminder of what has happened. Humanism has played itself out. And so what do you think? What's the score at the end of the game here? If this were going to be the final assessment of history, would we say, well, that was real smart of men back in the Renaissance and Enlightenment to cut themselves off from God, from divine revelation, from seeing themselves as the creatures of God, cut themselves off from that worldview, for instance, that Calvin develops in the Institutes of the Christian Religion, and start out fresh on their own? What can we know based on our reason? Descartes was sure of one thing, that he existed, and then God gets pulled into the picture and so forth. Starting with man at the center, the most foundational truth and value, we end up by the end of the 19th century with a complete breakdown in philosophy, science, and in politics. That's quite an apologetic in itself if you just know the history of philosophy. The second thing I want to do by way of retrospect, I've summarized Schaefer in terms of humanism's breakdown. I'd like to give you a series of characteristics that I think in retrospect summarize what the spirit of the age is as we come to the end of the century. Not everybody exemplifies each of these characteristics. I already know that. I'm purposely being general. Some people might think over general. But it seems to me that these are the things, as we enter into our own century, that are on people's minds or which and culturally are influencing them. First, a divided field of knowledge. This is something of a reminder of what Schaefer has just said to us. Men do not believe that they can use a single principle of explanation and account for everything they know. That is, what we know is going to have to be divided. Some things are explained in terms of psychological freedom or moral value. Other things will be explained in terms of historical development and natural constitution. And we can't bring these two together. A divided field of knowledge. And because the field of knowledge has been divided, we have a whole plethora of non-cognitivist schools of thought which are basically anti-rational. Nature has been separated from reason from the days of Hume's skepticism. Reason can't help you even understand the natural world. And that dichotomy between nature and reason is itself dichotomized from the realm of values. And so far from arriving at a unified worldview and a coherent worldview, humanism has fragmented one's worldview and outlook on life so that maybe this diagram will help you. What takes place in nature is separated from how we reason about it. Okay, so we have this, I'll keep it on one line, nature and reason with a slash between them, nature and reason dichotomized. And you can see all sorts of philosophers fitting into this. Hegel fits into it. He thinks eventually reason and nature must develop until they finally are one, but right now they're different. Quite clearly, Schopenhauer thinks that reason misleads us and we need to get back to nature and have an intuitive awareness that all is this driving, insatiable will, and on. I'm not going to give you the whole century over here. However, that, which is already a bad enough fragmentation of our thinking, that is separated from a completely different plane, which is the area of value and freedom for man. That by which we live and that which takes account of our subjectivity, what we perceive to be our freedom. And so, at the end of the 19th century, philosophy is characterized by a divided field of knowledge. Let me illustrate the divided field of knowledge. Basic question that everybody begins with in life, in religion, in philosophy, whatever you're doing, who am I? Well, first of all, there's the me of introspection, right? There's the me that I know like no one else knows. You know, my inner thoughts, feelings, how things, you know, affect me, my emotions, whatever it is. There's the me of introspection, but then there's the me of scientific analysis. If you let the scientist tell you who I am, then of course they've got all their formulas, they've got their explanation of my origin biologically, evolution, and then genetically and so forth, and they can talk about, you know, the condition of my heart and lungs and what my weight may be in height and how fast I can run. You can do all these sorts of scientific things. Now, what's the relationship, though, between the me of introspection that feels freedom, subjectivity, emotion, meaning, drive, desire, aim, purpose, and the me of scientific analysis that doesn't include any of those things? So who am I? Am I the me that science describes, or I'm the me that I feel internally? Philosophy has come to a point where there's a divided field of knowledge. Secondly, there is a loss of objectivity in philosophy by the end of the 19th century. Rationalism, as it has worked itself out, has come to the conclusion that at best we have mere appearances. At best, we know things as they appear, and the absolute, ultimate reality is unknowable. So by the end of the 19th century, there is a desire to escape what's called the constructivism of Kant's philosophy. Called constructivism, but because Kant said the objects of knowledge, what we know in reason, are constructed by us, rather than taken passively from the world. Everything we know is a combination of the input from the manifold of time and space and our minds constructing actively an intelligible object of knowledge. So we don't really know the world as it is, we only know things as they appear. And so philosophers are looking for a way to
escape the constructivism of Kant and then its relativism that goes along with that, and to reestablish the possibility of knowledge, knowledge of an objectively existing universe. Thirdly, at the end of the 19th century, we see a loss of optimism about man, a real loss of confidence about man himself. Man is not the proud, capable being of the Enlightenment. At the end of the 19th century, man is far from rational. Notice how many schools of thought that we've looked at have pointed to the non- or irrational aspects of man. Man is moved by irrational and destructive aggressions and fears. At the end of the 19th century, it's not too much to generalize saying that men looked upon themselves as uneasy, anxious, alienated, how often the theme of alienation comes up, and introspective. At one point, W.T. Jones puts it this way, and I think it's so apt. He says, it was not a happy age. No one would say it was a happy age. I mean, as a generalization, obviously some people were happy momentarily. Okay, so you give a birthday party for your little girl, you have some moments of happiness. We're not talking about happiness in that, you know, elementary way. But in general, how a man feels about himself, it's not a happy time. There's a sense of cosmic disorientation. There's no scheme of things now in terms of which men can see their lives. And there's quite an emphasis upon the absurdity of the situation in which we live. So, a loss of optimism about man, a loss of confidence. Fourthly, at the end of the 19th century, the focus in philosophical reasoning has come to be on, quote, the subject. Now, this began long ago, of course, in the Renaissance and Enlightenment, where Descartes begins with man, okay? We begin with man, and our philosophy develops out from man as a self-conscious being. Eventually, Kant says, well, it's man, the subject, that constructs the objects of knowledge. And then throughout the 19th century, over and over again, there's a return to this focus on the subject of thinking, or on consciousness. What is consciousness? How does consciousness function? An interest in what we now call existential problems. Who am I? Why am I here? What should I be committed to? There's a search for immediacy, like the Romantic movement. Let's get away from all these divisions and try to just immediately be aware of our experience. The search for an undivided self. So at the end of the 19th century, man-centered philosophy has come to focus all the more on the subject of life, man, the subject of thinking. Fifthly, reality is seen in a materialistic light. The tendency is to see reality in a materialistic way at the end of the 19th century. Sixthly, reality is seen in a developmental light or evolutionary light. These last two considerations, materialistic and developmental, might be summarized as a naturalistic perspective on the world and man. Seventhly, philosophy has come to focus on social theory, psychology, and history instead of metaphysics. There's a great deal more interest in social theory, psychology, and history than in traditional metaphysical concerns. What is the nature of reality? Man's place in the cosmos and things of that nature. Eighthly, there are no absolute values, no guiding criteria. And ninth, when we get to the end of the 19th century, there is a turn in the direction of considering the relationship of language to reality. It would be overgeneral and in that sense somewhat false
But I think a good approximation of the truth to say, in a sense, 20th century philosophy becomes preoccupied with language. How does language relate to reality and then help us resolve these difficulties about nature, science, man, value, and so forth? The answer in a wide variety of conflicting ways is given in the 20th century, but so many of them are via the route of language, a consideration of what language shows us about ourselves or about reality. All right, so I've given you two retrospectives. One, Schaefer's discussion of the breakdown in humanism. Secondly, nine characteristics, or eight, depending on how you want to count them, characteristics as general features of the thinking and cultural influence at the end of the 19th century. Now, by way of prospect, looking ahead into the 20th century that we're going to be studying. All right, so now looking ahead to the 20th century, I want to openly acknowledge, as I'm going to be teaching this, I mean, this is our own century, so we've gotten so close to the subject, it's kind of claustrophobic. You know, and what we're calling the 20th century is really being, in a sense, artificially divided from the 19th. As a matter of fact, there are very important transitional figures that begin their life and their career in the 19th century, and their influence and teaching continues into the 20th. Okay, so we don't have any notion that people woke up on the first day of the 20th century and said, okay, now we have to start new schools of philosophy. Obviously, it didn't happen that way. Give you some examples. Process philosophy, we're going to be looking at in just a few moments. Henry Bergson and Alfred North Whitehead. Bergson was born in 1859. Whitehead was born in 1861. Bergson died in 1941, Whitehead in 1947. Okay, so we have essentially men who begin their lives in the middle of the 19th century, in them just before the middle of the 20th. Transitional figures, just to illustrate the blurring. Pragmatism. Is pragmatism a 19th century movement or a 20th? Well, it was certainly up and running in the 19th century, although I tend to think that it's primarily 20th century in its effect and its cultural impact. But if you look at Peirce, he was born in 1839, died in 1914. William James, the pragmatist, 1842, died in 1910, and particularly John Dewey, the man that perhaps is best known as a pragmatist or an instrumentalist, was born in 1859, died in 1952. Now, I was already alive in 1952, and so now we're moving from the 19th century into the 20th and bringing it all the way down to the second half of the 20th century. Or idealism, neo-Hegelian idealism. Is that a 19th century movement, or is that something that you should consider in the 20th? W.T. Jones puts it in the 19th century volume. I'm considering it in the 20th. But there's reason for both of us handling it that way. F.H. Bradley, the best-known neo-Hegelian idealist, was born in 1846, but he died in 1924. And the main reason I'm treating him in the 20th century is because I don't think you can really understand linguistic analysis and, the ethos of it, the spirit of it, for sure, and then many of the criticisms that are offered and concerns of linguistic analysis, if you don't see the neo-Hegelian idealism against which the analysts were violently reacting. And you've already seen a measure of that violence. I've been trained in linguistic analysis. We got to Hegel. I mean, it was all I could do to keep from saying, what on earth is this guy talking about? Get precise, Hegel. And so I consider the idealists in the 20th century, if nothing else, they dominated for a quarter of the century, we can say, but you have to understand that to see the most important movement or most relevant